5 o'clock, you're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for the KBOO News. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories, which can be made from organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com. Also, Pete's Coffee and Tea, now offering Ethiopian Supernatural, a certified organic coffee processed by age-old natural methods. For a limited time at Pete's retail stores or on the web at PETS.com. Tonight, the regular KBOO News has been preempted to bring you some special pre-election coverage by Pacifica News Network. This is it's called Informed Dissent. So first, we're going to listen to Free Speech Radio News in its entirety, followed by Pacifica News Network Informed Dissent. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned. For Thursday, the 28th of September, 2006, this is Free Speech Radio News from KPFK in L.A., Emad Abogado. President Bush goes to the Senate to meet and praise Republicans on their near passage of detainee legislation. Indian authorities bar a Kashmiri human rights activist from traveling to France to receive an award. And we'll hear about the abuse and neglect of girls in New York's juvenile detention centers.
Throwing kids into prison-like places doesn't help them.
He put his foot behind the back of my leg and he tripped me up. And I was dropped on the floor. And another staff member came behind this guy and they had my legs and one had my upper torso.
We'll bring you these stories and more on today's newscast, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. The U.S. government has moved to impose sanctions on Thailand in the aftermath of the military coup. The Southeast Asian nation has been governed by a group of generals since last week's surprise ouster of Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra. The U.S. sanctions will cut off millions of dollars of military aid to Thailand. The coup leaders have announced they will name an interim prime minister over the weekend. Iraqi police have found at least 40 bodies dumped in Baghdad since yesterday. All of the bodies bore signs of torture and gunshot wounds. At least 21 other people died in the Iraqi capital today as a result of shootings or bombings. A car bomb outside of a Baghdad restaurant killed 5 people today and injured more than 30 others. The attack on the restaurant comes as many Muslims are fasting during daylight hours in observance of Ramadan. Peace talks between the Lord's Resistance Army rebels and the government of Uganda have hit a rocky moment. Emmanuel Okella reports from Kampala, Uganda.
Lord's Resistance Army rebel leader Joseph Kony has asked his troops to vacate the 2 designated demobilization points and has ordered his negotiators to withdraw from peace talks in Juba. The move, which breaks the August 26th cessation of hostilities agreement with the government of Uganda, is in protest of the reported seizure of the 2 assembly locations in southern Sudan by the Uganda People's Defense Forces. Uganda's government information minister Kirunda Kivejinja denies the claim and says the troops are only deployed at the border to avert any unforeseen consequences.
It's our duty to protect Uganda. And so long as we are in Uganda, we are free to deploy our forces in a way that we are satisfied to ensure maximum safety for Ugandans.
Over 2,000 LRA fighters were earlier reported to be at the said assembly locations. Rebel negotiators on Wednesday kept away from the talks, which are seen as the best solution to the 20-year conflict. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Okella reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Unsafe water and lack of basic sanitation contribute to the deaths of an estimated 1.5 million children under 5 each year, according to UNICEF Executive Director Ann Veneman. A report released today by UNICEF indicates that 425 million children do not have access to a safe water supply, and more than 980 million lack access to adequate sanitation. The Yanacocha gold mine, whose majority stockholder is the U.S.-based Newmont Corporation, has accepted responsibility for the contamination of water supplies in an area in northern Peru. Pamela Cueva reports from Lima.
Residents from the town of Combayo in the northern province of Cajamarca have been protesting for months about the use of local water supplies by the Nervi Yanacocha gold mine. The amount of water used by the mine has caused local wells to run dry and the chemicals used in the process to extract gold has poisoned local water bodies. Yanacocha had to suspend its operation in late August due to the protest by Combayo residents that blocked roads used by the mining company. The local residents were demanding compensation for water contamination, more jobs, and the end of the persecution of the mining company's critics. One campesino, Isidro Llanos, was killed during the protest, and the circumstances surrounding his death have not been clarified. Government-mediated talks over the weekend between local residents and the managers of Yanacocha ended with a promise from the mining company to finance the construction of a water treatment plant in Combayo. Yanacocha is Latin America's largest and most productive gold mine. Cajamarca is Peru's second poorest province and ranks third in malnutrition. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pamela Cueva with Alfredo Cuadros from Lima.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has signed landmark global warming legislation into effect. The new law will force California to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 25% by the year 2020, bringing it into line with the efforts of nations that have ratified the Kyoto Protocol. Brian Edwards-Tickert has more.
California's new global warming law won't stop the polar ice caps from melting, but it probably will help its Republican governor get reelected. The legislation has overwhelming support among Californians, and Arnold Schwarzenegger's endorsement drew support from state Democratic leaders and the nation's largest environmental groups. In his remarks, Schwarzenegger emphasized that combating greenhouse gas emissions is not at odds with his pro-business agenda.
We will create a whole new industry that will pump up our economy. A clean tech industry that creates jobs, sparks new cutting-edge technology, and is a model for the rest of the nation and the rest of the world.
The law puts Schwarzenegger at odds with the Bush administration, but strengthens efforts to build a coordinated international effort to rein in greenhouse gases. Business interests that lobbied against it announced they'll now try to shape the bill's implementation. Most want a pollution credit trading system. Environmental justice groups have expressed reservations that such a system might concentrate polluting facilities in poorer areas. In San Francisco, I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
A new poll finds 60% of Iraqis approve attacks on U.S. forces, and slightly more than that want U.S. troops to leave within a year. The poll, conducted for the University of Maryland's Program on International Policy Attitudes, found that almost 4 in 5 Iraqis say the U.S. military force in Iraq provokes more violence than it prevents. 3/4 say they think the U.S. plans to keep military bases in Iraq permanently. Meantime, a key Republican in Washington tried to downplay the importance of the Iraq war today. Mississippi Senator Trent Lott spoke to FSRN shortly after meeting with President Bush.
Nah, none of that. Y'all the only ones that obsess on that. We don't, and the real people out in the real world don't, for the most part. No, I mean, look, what do they want us to do? The question is, do you want us to cut and run? Would people like for us to find a way for the situation to improve? Sure. I mean, regardless of your point of view, philosophy, party, anything else, it has not gone as well as we'd like for it to do. And it's hard for Americans, all of us, including me, to understand what's wrong with these people. Why do they kill other people of other religions because of religion? Why do they hate the Israelis and despise their right to exist? Why do they hate each other? Why are Sunnis killing Shiites? How do they tell the difference? They all look the same to me. So for an average American, whether it's Mississippi or Massachusetts, we just don't, it's hard for us to grasp this.
George Bush came to visit with Senate Republicans to praise their near passage of the detainee legislation and other security-related legislation. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
The Senate is about to pass administration-backed legislation on the trial and treatment of detainees. The House passed the bill yesterday. In the legislation, 75 inmates accused of war crimes at Guantanamo Bay would proceed through a judicial military procedure. It also guides American interrogators on the treatment of detainees. President Bush visited with Republican senators at the Capitol for about half an hour, where they talked about the war on terror. The president praised the Senate and the House for pushing legislation he calls a war tool.
The American people need to know we're working together to win this war on terror. Our most important responsibility is to protect the American people from further attack. And we cannot be able to tell the American people we're doing our full job unless we have the tools necessary to do so.
An amendment to reinstate the right for a detainee to challenge their detention, also known as habeas corpus, was defeated 58-41. One Democrat joined all but four Republicans to defeat the measure. Chair of the Judiciary Committee, Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania, said without habeas corpus guarantees, he could no longer support the whole bill.
I'm not going to vote for a bill which is patently unconstitutional on its face. We'll not do that.
Democrats who say they oppose portions of the bill for reasons such as lacking legal standards or that it sets a negative precedent for the treatment of Americans abroad will be forced to make a decision whether they'll vote against the bill or reap the benefits of negative advertisements on the campaign trail. Senate Democratic leaders were unwilling to state their position before the vote and were not pressuring their caucus to vote any certain way. This is one of a series of security-related bills the administration and Republicans wanted to pass, but time is running out for the other provisions, including the domestic surveillance program. The House of Representatives is poised to pass that bill today, but it will unlikely get through the Senate. The House version would give broad powers to the president to conduct warrantless surveillance of Americans before and after a terrorist attack. It would also collect and store these masses of information. This is a provision the administration pushed for. Representative Heather Wilson, Republican from New Mexico, authored the bill. Her press release says this bill will set a standard to allow surveillance of people in the United States when there is a reasonable belief they have communicated with a suspected terrorist. The bill also has a provision which would prohibit any American who has been wiretapped in this program from challenging their case in court. Democratic Representative Gerald Nadler from New York strongly opposes the bill.
When you're going to have any kind of surveillance, you have to get a warrant. You can't just let the president or the FBI director do what he wants, because then you get the J. Edgar Hoovers tapping Martin Luther King. You've got to go to some court and show some legitimate reason why there's reason to believe that this guy is committing a crime or about to commit a crime or danger to national security or something for a basis of the warrant. I hope it won't pass the Senate. That is certainly a saving grace, unlike the torture bill, which is going to pass both houses. This won't go into law. And if, God willing, we get a Democratic majority in the House in the election, then we can do a more reasonable bill.
For it to die in the Senate is a likely scenario. The Senate has four versions of the legislation addressing the issue, and no agreement has been made on how to proceed. And while the president praised Republicans for the work it did accomplish, Democrats are also calling a victory. Democratic leader Harry Reid of Nevada called this month September meltdown, mostly because the Republicans haven't yet gotten their domestic surveillance program passed and because a leaked intelligence report said the war in Iraq is making terrorism worse. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
While senators debated Bush's interrogation legislation in Washington, activists took to the streets of San Francisco to pressure California's Democratic senators to filibuster the president's plan. Joshua Smith reports from San Francisco, where protesters rallied in orange jumpsuits, rolling a life-size replica of the cages in which Guantanamo detainees are imprisoned.
Act Against Torture and other groups organized an event today demanding an end to torture. Their message was wide-ranging, protesting Guantanamo Bay, Abu Ghraib, and Bagram in Afghanistan. The day took on new focus when the House passed the Military Commissions Act late Wednesday night.
The way the bill is written, it gives the president and the administration great leeway in determining who is a material supporter of terrorists. Could be us standing here today objecting to the government's policies.
Buff Whitman Bradley works with the Presente Affinity Group, a nonviolent direct action civil disobedience organization.
So they could come and take us and throw us in jail and say, we don't have to show the evidence against these people. We know and we have the evidence, but we don't have to show it because it would jeopardize national security. So we're all in jeopardy. Every citizen in this country is in jeopardy now because of this legislation.
Sarah Parker is with Interfaith Women for Peace. She says the so-called compromise legislation would give the president a free hand to interpret the Geneva Conventions.
It would let the Pentagon declare almost anyone an enemy combatant and gives torturers retroactive immunity and bars detainees from challenging the legality of their detention or their treatment via habeas corpus, which we believe is a fundamental human right that's been protected since 1215 AD. And it also instantly throws away every current Guantanamo-related case in court.
In Washington, Congress was expected to give final approval to the Military Commissions Act. Activists say the bill is unconstitutional and promise a battle in court. For FSRN in San Francisco, I'm Joshua Smith.
According to a recent report issued by Human Rights Watch and the American Civil Liberties Union, girls in New York's juvenile prisons are being abused and neglected by state authorities. The report, titled Custody and Control, Juvenile Justice, provides an in-depth look at the abuses and neglect suffered by girls confined in two remote New York juvenile facilities known as Tryon and Lansing. The facilities are operated by the New York Office of Children and Family Services and are the only two high-security facilities in New York State holding girls. Danutisha Franich reports from New York.
According to Human Rights Watch and the ACLU, girls in New York State prisons experience abusive physical restraints and other forms of abuse and neglect and are denied the mental health, educational, and other rehabilitative services they need. Mia Louise, a lawyer with Human Rights Watch and American Civil Liberties Union, is the author of the report. She says that frequent strip searches and the use of force were among the most common abuses reported.
The most kind of striking one was something called a restraint. There's a procedure that they call a restraint that staff is supposed to use on girls when girls are completely out of control. It's a crisis and every other measure has been tried. What they do is to seize a girl from behind and force her face down onto the ground. What we found is that this procedure is used much more frequently than it should be. It's being used for minor problems. The other thing we found is that girls are being injured when this restraint is being applied.
The majority of the 150 girls at Tryon and Lansing are 15 or 16 years old, although some are as young as 12. A disproportionate number of them are African Americans from families whose relatives have also been incarcerated. 19-year-old Juanita Crawford spent a year and a half at Lansing Correctional Facility. She describes how she was restrained in a cafeteria for refusing to eat.
Basically, they put you on the floor. He put his foot behind the back of my leg and he tripped me up. And I was dropped on the floor. And another staff member came behind this guy and they had my legs and one had my upper torso. And I was handcuffed by my director. And, you know, when they felt like I was calm and I wasn't talking, you get put in your room and you get handcuffed to this bedpost.
The New York State Office of Children and Family Services, or OCFS, is the state agency whose Department of Rehabilitative Services administers such juvenile facilities. The ACLU says that although OCFS is charged with rehabilitating children, it often fails to serve them. Lewis says that this failure continues because there is little or no meaningful oversight of conditions in OCFS facilities.
Throwing kids into prison-like places doesn't help them. It doesn't rehabilitate them. OCFS has a very lousy track record in terms of its success in rehabilitating children. And we have seen in other states that much more humane, community-based, and cheaper models of rehabilitation actually work a lot better than what's happening here.
Brian Marchetti is a spokesman for the Office of Children and Family Services. He criticizes Human Rights Watch and the ACLU for not providing a copy of the reports to the agency before its release, as the two groups did for the news media.
OCFS has been forthcoming in providing any and all documents that we were legally able to disclose. We are absolutely baffled by these assertions. We have to question their motives. Is this report to improve programs for children or just to see their names and headlines and promote their own agenda?
Girls make up a little less than 20% of children taken into custody, and many of their needs are often overlooked. Aileen Chen is a senior policy associate for juvenile justice and youth services at Citizens Committee for Children of New York.
What we found based on our own research is that more needs to be done to increase the agency's internal capacity to hear and respond to youth complaints in a timely manner. Also, there's a need to improve staff training and ensure that all youth workers have a strong understanding of female adolescent development and best practices.
The report recommends support for a bill that creates an independent Office of the Child Advocate to oversee all juvenile justice and foster care facilities. I'm Danutasha Franiec, Free Speech Radio News, New York.
Hewlett-Packard's ousted chairwoman told Congress today that she was not aware that illegal methods were used in the investigation against the company's board members. FSRN's Yame Sher reports from the hearing room.
Lurid details about HP's internal probe emerged as lawmakers grilled the company's ex-chairwoman Patricia Dunn. Starting this January, the company hired a detective firm in an effort to stop a leak of company secrets to the media. A network of outside investigators used fraudulent identities to obtain telephone records of HP employees and reporters, surveilled them and their relatives, and sifted through their garbage. Dunn, who hired those investigators, says she was left in the dark about their tactics.
I dispute having ever understood or being told that the fraudulent use of identity was a part of this investigation.
Congress members focused their questions on a PowerPoint report that was presented to Dunn by the investigative team. The report outlined the investigation's techniques, including, quote, undercover operations. Democratic Representative Jay Inslee of Washington.
It appears to me that you had already stepped up over the line of being willing to falsify the identity or the role or the responsibility of a person in order to obtain this information. Is that a fair statement?
I think you can probably appreciate what happens when you go into a meeting and someone's got a 30-page PowerPoint deck and you've got limited time and you say, let's get to the meat of the matter here. I want to know, who do you think did this?
Larry Sonsini, HP's outside lawyer and one of Silicon Valley's most influential figures, also appeared at the hearing. At the time, he assured company executives that all its activities were legal. Three other key HP executives who were involved in the spying scandal refused to testify. Other than Congress, the SEC as well as FBI have launched separate investigations. For Free Speech Radio News, Ye Meixie on Capitol Hill.
Indian authorities have denied travel documents to Kashmiri human rights activist Parviz Imroz. Imroz was awarded the Ludovic Trieu Prize 2006 and had planned to travel to France to receive the award next month. Shanawaz Khan reports.
Parviz Imroz is one of the very few human rights activists in Indian administered Kashmir. The Jammu and Kashmir Coalition of Civil Society, headed by Himin Srinagar, documents human rights abuses mostly by the Indian troops in the region. He has particularly fought against enforced disappearances in Kashmir and is the patron of the Association of the Parents of Disappeared Persons, Kashmir. A lawyer by profession, Parviz has been awarded the prestigious Ludovic Trierix Prize for 2006. An award given by lawyers to lawyers, Ludovic Trierix Prize was created in 1984, with Nelson Mandela being the first recipient. The award is given jointly by the Human Rights Institutes of the Bar of Bordeaux, Brussels, Paris, and the European Bar Human Rights Institute. Parviz was to receive the award at a ceremony in France next month, but he has been denied a passport by the Indian authorities. Parviz says he applied for a new passport in February 2005, after his earlier passport expired.
And since more than 20 months, there is no formal refusal. They are not giving any answer. All I have been told that the intelligence agencies have not okayed my passport. I believe that my passport has been withheld only because they don't want that I should go abroad and attend the international conference and expose the lies of the government here regarding the human rights.
Parviz says denying a passport violates Indian laws as well as international covenants, but adds that Indian authorities have a history of denying passport to people on political considerations. The organizers of the Ludovic Trierix Prize in Europe have condemned the denial of Imroz's passport. Human rights bodies in Europe are expected to stage a protest in front of Indian embassies on this issue. In the absence of a passport, Parviz will be represented at the award ceremony by fellow human rights activist Khurram Parviz.
This is an honor for me to represent a person like Parviz, but at the same time it's unfortunate that Parviz himself can't be there.
Khurram explains why Parviz has been denied the passport.
Parviz is amongst those people who have been giving a tough time to the government of India by presenting the reports and by speaking for truth and against the human rights violations which continue unabated in Kashmir. So people who have become an eyesore for the government, they are trying to take this revenge by isolating them and by frustrating them from not going out and by isolating them from the rest of the world.
The practice of denying passports is not limited to human rights activists in Kashmir. Separatist leaders like Syed Ali Shah Gilani and Shabir Shah have been denied passports, while as for common people, acquiring a passport is also a hard debt. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shahnawaz Khan.
And now, from his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Inheritance of madness. As the American congressional election season nears, prepare for the inundation of political ads from the national political parties and their affiliates, known as 527s. It's a safe bet that they'll concentrate on several basic themes: fear, patriotism, and more fear. Rarely will they rely on truth or reason. In national politics, the appeal is to the gut, to the ephemeral emotions that roil in the belly like hatred and fear. And why not? Hasn't it worked before? For the right, the strategy is simple. Paint anybody who doesn't support the addle-brained president as unpatriotic, soft on the so-called war on terror, or an Osama lover. While those words may not be used, the underlying themes are as clear as crystal. For the quasi-left, the themes will no doubt be, we're not soft, a qualified patriotism, and a claim to competence. Neither side of the nation's biggest political divide will call for an end to the Iraq war, for neither side wishes to appear as weak. It is for folks like these that activist Anthony Ornove has written his newest book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. The book owes its existence as much to the work of famed historian Howard Zinn as to the will of Ornove, for it was based on Zinn's earlier work entitled Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal, which ably challenged the official lies and excuses that led to the continuing war in Southeast Asia in the late 60s and early 70s. Here, Ornove takes on the Tories, who adore Emperor Bush, and the Senate Dems, who fear being called weak for bringing us to this disaster and fumbling the way forward. Lately, the corporate press has been subtly promoting the notion pushed by the White House that the low-level civil war can only be made worse by the exit of the U.S. In the Vietnam War, the generals warned against the domino effect sure to follow Vietnamese victory in the war. Not only didn't it ever happen, but today, a half a century later, the two countries are trading with each other. As Ornove writes, perhaps the greatest fear of many anti-war activists who now support the occupation is that the withdrawal of U.S. troops will lead to civil war. This idea has been encouraged repeatedly by supporters of the war. Sectarian fault lines in Iraq are inexorably pushing the country towards civil war unless we actually intervene decisively to stem it, explained one U.S. Army official, making the case for a continued U.S. presence. As veteran Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk points out, though, colonial powers have long used the rationale that they cannot withdraw lest the natives collapse into civil war. In 1920, British Prime Minister David Lloyd George warned of civil war in Iraq if the British Army left, just as the Americans now threaten the Iraqis with civil war if they leave. For Americans, history is what happens to other people. It doesn't impact Americans who only look forward, never backwards. It is precisely U.S. historical myopia that led to this disaster, and not learning from the past only ensures additional disasters. As for Iraq, Ornove tells us the U.S. is hardly in a position to squelch civil war, and indeed, it really doesn't want to, he writes. But Washington is not preventing a civil war from breaking out. In fact, occupation authorities are deliberately pitting Kurds against Arabs, Shia against Sunni, and faction against faction to influence the character of the future government, following a classic divide-and-rule strategy. If we are to continue to claim to live in something called a democracy, why should people continue to vote for people who oppose their ideas and aspirations? Why not vote for people who really oppose the war? Why vote for people who have every intention to betray your vote? Why vote for more disaster? The world very badly needs change. Why vote for the same old thing? From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Today's newscast was produced by Simba Russo, Monica Lopez, and Aaron Glantz. Our Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. You can listen to this newscast or any other FSRN newscast or documentary online at fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. We welcome your comments, questions, and story ideas. Just email us at comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.
This is Informed Dissent, Pacifica Radio's national program looking at this year's midterm elections and beyond. Does marching matter anymore? In this segment, we ask what role, if any, does the anti-war movement have in electoral politics?
Into thinking that the system is going to meet our needs because we elect the right kind of people.
We are seeing that electoral work is mobilizing a great deal of grassroots energy.
The top U.S. commander in Iraq, General John Abizaid, said last week that at least 140,000 U.S. troops will have to remain in Iraq for another year and a half. President Bush has said on numerous occasions that troop levels are dependent on what his commanders on the ground tell him. So, as Democratic lawmakers say they're not willing to cut funding for the war despite their opposition, it's likely that a significant number of U.S. troops will remain in Iraq for some time to come. In this segment, Sonali Kohaktar, host of the show Uprising at Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, takes a look at the anti-war movement and asks whether it has a role in this year's midterm elections.
Democrat Ned Lamont's victory in Connecticut's primary elections brought a brief moment of vindication for the anti-war movement this summer. Lamont's campaign was based heavily on a self-funded anti-war platform and edged out the hawkish Democrat Joe Lieberman. Still, there remains little hope for a short-term end to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan unless Republicans lose their slim majority in Congress. Many anti-war activists are backing Democratic congressional candidates. But are Democrats on the whole committed to peace? Speaking to a variety of anti-war activists, I found that there is little, if any, unity on an anti-war electoral strategy. The Answer Coalition is one of the largest anti-war groups in the country, with a reputation for mobilizing huge demonstrations. Gloria LaRiva is an organizer with Answer. I asked her what Answer's position was on the upcoming November elections.
The elections to us are really of little significance in the matter of the issue of war, which is a looming issue for all people in this country and really the people of the Middle East and around the world. We've seen clearly the Democrats only want to outdo the Republicans in their claims that they can win the war, and they've been virtually unanimous in both houses of Congress in voting for tens of billions of dollars in funding.
That was Gloria LaRiva with Answer. Rahul Mahajan is author of Full Spectrum Dominance and The New Crusade. He is also the publisher of Empire Notes, a print and audio blog. I asked him to respond to Gloria LaRiva.
I agree with Gloria on a point and disagree with her on one. As things have progressed, the Democratic Party leadership is offering no sign of hope that anything better would come of the Iraq occupation, even if they were in charge of the White House. Let alone of Congress. There's Democrats who have taken better positions on the war, but there's no coherent position emerging from the party that is at all distinguishable from the Republicans. They are somewhat different, I think, on the question of a larger war in the Middle East, although, again, on the war with Lebanon, they were completely in step with the Republicans. I still think, however, that, for one thing, this 2006 elections was a huge missed opportunity for the anti-war movement. I think we had the political conditions to try to create and foster a large number of anti-war political candidates from the anti-war movement who could have, even if most of them didn't win, really tried to change the debate. That hasn't happened, and it hasn't happened partly as a result of a lack of any kind of electoral focus from the movement.
Gloria, how do you respond to that, particularly to the idea of putting up anti-war candidates?
There may be from time to time an individual in one state or another or one individual office, particularly from the independent parties who will run on an anti-war ticket. However, that doesn't change the really locked-up situation in the U.S. government in both houses of Congress, where, for the most part, even when you look at someone like Cynthia McKinney, who really stuck to her principles, who was drummed out of office twice by a very right-wing campaign against her in Georgia because of her position in supporting Palestine. The thing is, it was because of her anti-war stance. If you do like Cynthia McKinney and you stick to your guns, you get booted out. And I want to point out that the Democrats tried to outdo the Republicans on the issue of the Lebanon war and say that no matter what, Israel had to be defended. But in the Iraq war, both parties have almost unanimously voted for this massive war funding. You can't say that you oppose a war or you're concerned or you want a timetable if you're funding it, if you're fueling it.
Rahul, would you like to respond on this particular point?
First of all, Cynthia McKinney, you know, did not completely stick to her guns. I think it's important for progressives to note that neither Cynthia McKinney nor Dennis Kucinich voted against the House resolution basically approving everything Israel did. The vote was 410-8. There were only 8 people in Congress who voted against it, and neither McKinney nor Kucinich was one of them, and I think the left should hold them accountable too. McKinney lost in this last election primarily because of political mistakes she made herself. I actually don't believe there is any disagreement except on the rhetorical level. I think everybody understands that if you were a militant anti-war congressperson, you would have at least marginally more power to affect the debate and to affect politics there than if you were a militant anti-war local organizer in the street. People may claim they don't believe that, but you can tell from the attention they do pay to even progressive congresspeople who are not militantly anti-war that, you know, underneath they really do agree. And I think that I'm not talking about, you know, looking for an anti-war candidate and then supporting them, and I'm not simply talking about running symbolic candidacies from alternative parties, which can almost not hope to win a congressional seat. I'm talking about also building and throwing up ourselves anti-war candidates from the ranks of the movement who make a major play to get, presumably, in general, the Democratic Party nomination for congressional seats. That is something that we simply haven't done, and there was really a lot of scope for it in this election.
What about, Rahul, first, and then Gloria, the Ned Lamont victory in the primary in Connecticut?
Well, I think that it's a very important thing that we need to learn from. Joe Lieberman was punished for two things. One, because he didn't oppose the war, he supported the war in even more ridiculously hawkish terms than Bush. And secondly, because he seems to act as if he's in love with Bush. And it was very important to send a sanction. And I assure you that other, you know, so-called moderate or conservative-leaning Democrats took the message from the dethroning of Lieberman that a certain level of flirtation with the Bush administration is not a good idea. It was a grassroots mobilization. It was very rare that you actually managed to unseat an incumbent in a primary process on the basis of political principle and actually a specific issue, which is to say Iraq. That almost never happens. That kind of level of accountability for a politician's position on an issue almost never occurs. And it's important to know that this was a grassroots movement from liberal Democrats, Democratic partisans, bloggers who are very partisanly in favor of the Democratic Party, and not from the left and not from the anti-war movement, although obviously at the ground level they did swell the ranks. Those people are actually turning their outrage into the exercise of political power, whereas the anti-war movement isn't. On the flip side, one has to say, of course, that Ned Lamont is not some raging progressive, and he will settle down to be a pretty normal Democratic senator, not like Lieberman, but also probably not like Feingold.
Gloria LaRiva, your response?
Well, I think that it's very important not to tie our fortunes in ending the war or fighting for any other element of social justice to the outcome of an election. I'm sure that Rahul does not believe that either. For the ANSA coalition, we don't take positions on the elections in an official capacity at all. We know that individuals in our group may support a candidate or another, but it is truly always a mass movement that makes the effective change. Remember this, that the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War in the 72 election and even in the 68 election got very, very diverged into the election. Some of the most active people got into the Eugene McCarthy campaign and the other campaigns of the peace candidates, and they were extremely distressed when Nixon won twice.
So you're saying it was a big waste of energy?
I think that it was a waste to think that that was how the war was going to end. The war ended, of course, primarily because of the Vietnamese struggle, but also because of the refusal to fight and the people in the street who made it ungovernable in this country. Every day we have to fight the war, and I think that to be siphoned off into the movement, especially the Democratic Party, is a way of co-opting the movement. We've seen movements come and go and disappear into the Democrats when they found how they could possibly, with a little bit more push, could get a one person elected. We're not talking about an individual anti-war activist getting out in the street. We're talking about the mass movement. And maybe sometimes it's hard for people to picture mass movement because we're not at that point in a big way. Although September 24th last year was 300,000 people in D.C., unexpected. And the core of people who keep demonstrating are keeping this struggle alive. The war is extremely unpopular, and it's important for the anti-war movement to stay independent of those politics.
I want to remind our listeners that we're speaking with Gloria Lariva. She is an organizer in the Answer Coalition, and Rahul Mahajan, an author and publisher of Empire Notes. We're talking about the anti-war movement and how it may or may not relate to the congressional election coming up this November. I want to pose a question to the two of you, which is to take a look at how the right has gained power here in the United States and whether there are any lessons to be learned from them among progressives, given that they control so many branches of government, and the way in which they have organized has certainly utilized, although not exclusively, electoral politics. Rahul, what are your thoughts on what lessons the progressives can learn from the right?
Well, I think that's a really good way to frame it. There are several components to it, but I think the most relevant component is that the right, in order to mobilize and take power, has understood that it is important to colonize the existing institutions of power. They were completely politically marginal in 1970. They started with things like local school boards, which they took over, and then used those things to further build a base that would give them a mass movement behind which could then throw up larger political candidates and their own media stations and so on. And they've built step by step. They've colonized existing institutions and then used those as platforms from which to build new institutions. The left, although it has some institutions that are very important, like Pacifica, like Democracy Now!, has done nothing like that on that same scale. And part of it is because it comes in with this completely anti-institutional bias and this notion that you can just sort of make things happen by just bubbling up from the ground in some way that is highly unspecified. Mass protests, you know, they work at certain times in certain contexts. 300,000 people in the streets of D.C. in the Vietnam War era made a major difference to the conduct of the war. 300,000 people in D.C. last year made absolutely no discernible difference to anyone. And the reason is not because Nixon was a nice guy and Bush is not. The reason is because things have changed in the way that, you know, trying to exert pressure on the levers of power has also changed. And in that regard, I would say if you want to say don't, you know, divert our energy into electoral work, well, I don't see any energy to be diverted. I don't see a movement to be diverted into and to be destroyed by getting bound with electoral work. You have to also think about what are the kinds of things you can do that might make a difference, and nobody has any energy or desire anymore for some idea that mass on-the-ground mobilization is going to build and sustain itself and lead to change, whereas we are seeing that electoral work is mobilizing a great deal of grassroots energy.
All right, let's get Gloria's response to that. And also, Gloria, if you can touch on what are the long-term strategies of the Answer Coalition to achieving change?
Well, first, I don't think it's just a matter of diverting our time and resources that becomes a weakening of the anti-war movement. It's the illusions that are built into organizing and backing the Democratic Party or even the most of the independent candidates. It's having illusions about the electoral process in the United States giving us a voice. All these candidates are elected, and then war is carried out undeclared. Voting and the budgets that are passed, not only for war, but against workers' rights, everything that's taken place is without a voice. The main thing is that it's not just the diversion of resources, it is an illusion into thinking that the system is going to meet our needs because we elect the right kind of people. I do not believe that 300,000 people in the streets of Washington or the tens of thousands that march on any given day when a march is called is ineffective. You know, those are the kind of things that may not be so discernible. They certainly don't have Congress people running out of Congress to join our marches. We don't expect that. But that doesn't mean that they're not effective. What makes them effective is that it keeps the struggle alive in people's minds. Tens of millions of people are very insecure. They're unhappy about the war. They're opposed to the war. They just don't have a practice and a history and a legacy of marching and protesting. It's been a long time since the Vietnam War. It's a march for the youth to see that there is an activism. And the sentiments are there. It's not expressed so much in activism, but we have to keep on keeping on and having a determination that at some point there will be a qualitative change.
Well, it's not building, it's not growing, and there's no reason to say that, you know, one shouldn't march. Of course, marching can be a useful component, and in particular, the February 15th marches before the war were extremely important. The one since, I challenge anyone to produce any evidence of a discernible effect. You have to actually look at, you know, things like what kind of resources are going into these marches and what we're getting out of them. That's really the question. This idea that you're sort of going to take things on faith, that simply continuing to run in your well-worn rut where turnout is either declining or stabilizing and nobody can tell that it makes every difference, but you have to have faith that somehow you're building a foundation for the future, I don't see it. When I talk about looking at alternatives, like electoral work, that is simply one alternative. It's not like the only thing that you should do. I'm not talking about going in with any illusions, okay? I'm talking very much, I think the right wing didn't have illusions. I'm talking about doing whatever you do without illusions. That includes not having any illusions about some sort of magical power that street action has, simply because other kinds of street actions and entirely different consequences had power too. Don't have any illusions. If you think about having any illusions about electoral politics, look at John Kerry in 1971 and John Kerry in 2004. That is how that kind of thing progresses. You need to keep a movement that puts accountability even on the people it throws up itself. But doing this in the absence of illusions does not mean somehow recusing yourself from the process and from the working of all these institutions where so much power does lie.
What we march for and struggle for, because we don't just have demonstrations, we have forums, we have the impeachment campaign that many are involved in. Bush may finish out his term, but it's still an important propaganda and information for people that he is conducting war crimes. It's important to put that out. But it's not based on faith. It's based on history. Every progressive measure that's been carried out, from the most right-wing president, one of the most right-wing, Nixon, ending the war because of the opposition being so great, those who stuck to their guns and fought and struggled, peacefully, I must say, guns in a rhetorical sense, is that we finally prevailed. And the key is things go back in history sometimes, but we've got to keep moving forward and keep.
This is a faith-based interpretation of history.
Excuse me.
That's what it is.
Excuse me.
Okay.
You're so depressing.
Yeah.
I'm so glad I don't listen to you every day.
Okay.
I say keep on struggling and check our website, answercoalition.org.
Rahul Mahajan, final comments from you.
Start thinking about our successes and how to build on them instead of keeping on moving with the failed model. Now that we have major media institutions that are actually a success and reach millions of people every day, let us think about how to use them as a platform to build new institutions instead of simply to keep them going and remain stuck exactly where we are.
And Rahul, you want to give out your website as well?
Yeah, my website, www.empirenotes.org.
Rahul Mahajan is author of Full Spectrum Dominance and the New Crusade and publisher of Empire Notes. He was debating the issue of anti-war activism and elections with Gloria LaRiva, an organizer with the Answer Coalition. Jody Evans is the co-founder of Code Pink, an anti-war organization that has just launched a campaign called Give Peace a Vote. I asked her to explain what Code Pink's electoral strategy was.
It's to take a stand to vote for peace. You know, what we're seeing is that a majority of Americans say that we should be getting out of Iraq, but we're not seeing that effect in Congress. And we really need to, especially during campaign time where the energy about the war gets just sucked out by negative campaigns and we're seeing them being more stupid every time you look. This is to keep everybody focused on we need to get out of Iraq now. Remember that you need to vote that way. You need to call your politicians out and tell them they have to vote that way. and it keeps the issue out there. And what's great is that more than ever we have celebrities, musicians, artists coming out and saying, yes, I need to be here, and being bolder than we've seen in the past. The other night at the Hollywood Bowl, we had Willie Nelson dip his finger into pink and say, yes, I pledge to vote for peace.
Wow. So, and in addition to Willie Nelson, I understand Suzanne Sarandon, Alice Walker, Jackson Brown, and others have also joined?
And Cornel West, Robbie Canal, Steve Earle. I mean, people are talking about doing concerts. We have artists talking about doing artwork. It's also kind of reminding us of the quagmire that, you know, we didn't get out of, that we were kicked out of 30 years earlier. We're noticing as we go out that people are just hungry for something to do, and it helps remind them that they need to be engaged, just that one act. And as soon as we have gotten some people to sign the pledge, they're like, okay, I'm going to take this and get friends to sign it. What we will do with the pledge is, besides, you know, getting voters to remember what they're voting for, is we get the zip code, and then we let the elected official, both the congressional member and the senator in that area, know these people will only vote if you have a strong stand to get us out of Iraq as soon as possible.
Now, I think that the idea sounds very, very creative, but if the officials who are running for office, if the incumbents and the candidates themselves are not even talking about the war in Iraq, if they're instead focusing on immigration, same-sex marriage, and really using them as these hot-button topics to rally conservative voters, what is a Code Pink peacemaker to do?
Well, we have many activities, mostly starting in October, so they're right at the heart of the election cycle, that are going to bring this issue to the forefront. Very visible, very in your face. We have International Peace Day coming up on the 21st. We have our 300 locals all over the country doing actions at their congressional member's office or senator's office, doing sit-ins, depending on who's got the tightest race. We'll be, for a week, very heavily involved in Washington with nonviolent direct actions, with marches, bringing the issue to the forefront.
I'm speaking with Jody Evans. She is the co-founder of Code Pink, and Code Pink has just launched a new campaign called Give Peace a Vote, where they're calling on people to become peacemakers by signing a peace pledge and committed to enrolling at least 100 people to sign a vote for peace pledge. You can find out more on givepeaceavote.org. That's givepeaceavote.org. Jody, let's talk a little bit briefly about the options that people have at the election. I mean, essentially, when you're talking about people voting on a platform of peace, they're faced with the choices of Republicans and Democrats. There's not that many Democrats that are as decisive on pulling out of Iraq as perhaps you'd like. What is your opinion of the Democrats' position?
Well, it's disgusting. You know, why are we so dumb that the Republicans are right there ready to lead from their base? And we're frightened away by that because people won't take it if they're afraid, oh, but I might lose something instead of I might gain my own base. It's baffling to look at the Democratic Party and see how spineless and lacking in leadership they are.
When you have all of these folks signed up, are you going to take it to Washington, D.C.? Do you have a particular goal of the number of people that you're trying to reach?
Well, this is actually a campaign that goes to 08. So we have a goal of 1 million before this election cycle, but that it will continue to build to 08.
So wait a minute. You have a long-term strategy?
Yes, we have a long-term strategy. Because this issue is affecting every other issue. You know, how do you have health care if you don't have the money? How do we, you know, fight global warming if we're having oil wars? Education. It's like this is the issue that we have to stay on. You know, we've heard from Bush that he's intent on invading other countries before 08. We have to use something to keep the feet of these congressional members and senators to the fire.
Jody Evans is the co-founder of Code Pink, talking about the Give Peace a Vote campaign, designed to encourage voters to vote for anti-war candidates. For Informed Dissent, I'm Sonali Kolhatkar from KPFK in Los Angeles.
Sonali Kolhatkar is the author of the new book, Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington Warlords and the Propaganda of Silence. Her show, Uprising, is heard weekday mornings on KPFK in Los Angeles. And now for a look at the world from outside of the box with Robert Knight.
I'm Robert Knight in New York. When the Republican Party increased its House majority in 2004, the war in Iraq was not as much of an electoral liability as it is in 2006. Unlike today, the administration was claiming progress in the war and pointing to a 40% troop reduction from the 192,000 first deployed in March of 2003. Emboldened by the military-supervised election of an occupation parliament in January 2005, President Bush began repeating, at every possible occasion, the hopeful mantra that, quote, "Our strategy can be summed up this way. As the Iraqis stand up, we will stand down, and then our troops can come home to a proud and grateful nation," end quote. But this time around, the White House cannot easily win the midterm elections based on tactical success or troop reductions. As the Iraqi resistance gained traction after 2004, the administration's claims of military success became more cautious, and now, this year, each time Bush has repeated the stand up and stand down mantra, he has significantly added the caveat that actual troop levels depend on ground commanders. That's a circumlocution for steady troop escalations, notwithstanding the concerns raised by Bush's own party and by ambitious Democrats. Republicans face a daunting dilemma, with U.S. troop levels now back up to 150,000, with increases to come in response to the growing insurgency and sectarian conflict ignited by the U.S. occupation. Iraqi troop training has failed to create an army that can operate independently of U.S. command and control. To put it simply, the administration cannot stand down because the Iraqi troops are not standing up, which is at the heart of the Republican dilemma in the midterm elections. Voters are unhappy with a war that has cost $500 billion and lost as many American lives as the September 11th attacks, not to mention the tens of thousands of Iraqis already dead, with 100 or more being killed almost every day. In order to save his party from a loss of both houses, President Bush has already hinted at the deus ex machina that he hopes will snatch electoral victory from the jaws of military defeat. And that is by taking on an even more intractable war than the one in Iraq, namely the mystical phenomenon known as the Global War on Terror. Less than a month ago, in an address to the American Legion, Bush shifted the focus of his rhetoric from his dubious claims of democratic success in Iraq to the fail-safe language of fear, saying, quote, "If we give up the fight in the streets of Baghdad, we will face the terrorists in the streets of our own cities," end quote. And according to polls, the tactic is working, with Bush's approval rating resurging to 40%, up from a low of 29% just a few weeks ago. Therefore, prudent observers would be well advised to expect from the White House an October surprise related to the global war on terror. Such a surprise need not be an actual event, since rumors of war and terror attacks can be just as effective. And it just so happens that the Bush administration has an army of coerced witnesses standing by to be trotted out at critical moments just before the election in the form of detainees recently shipped to Guantanamo from secret CIA gulags and outsourced torture centers around the world. And that's why the Bush administration has fought so hard recently to keep torture as an option, while backing away from the Geneva Conventions, immunizing American agents from prosecution for torture, and nullifying the right of habeas corpus. Those terms were embodied in the deceptive agreement made by the White House last week, despite the cosmetic objections of Senator John McCain. Thus, the way remains open for coerced and false testimony from tortured detainees to ultimately aid the current administration's tortured logic of the war in Iraq and the war on terror. For Informed Dissent, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Informed Dissent is produced by the Pacifica Foundation and community stations all over the country. The executive producer is Otis McClay. Technical direction by John Elmella and Delise. Mushroom Cloud Theater is written by David Dozer and performed by him and Janet Coleman. Original music is produced, written, and performed by Sean Rhodes. Remember, that's listeners like you who make this show possible, so please support your local community radio station, particularly as we approach Fund Drive. For Informed Dissent, I'm Mitch Jezerich in New York.
And it's nearly 6 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And you heard the man. Support your local community radio station. Our pledge drive or membership drive starts next Wednesday, October 4th. And we count on you, our listeners, to support your community radio station. Coming up next is Proverbial Perspectives. But be sure and stay tuned tomorrow, Friday, September 29th. For the morning news at 7 a.m. And then at 7:30, Ani and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. They'll speak with Jim Oberg of World Can't Wait about Portland's Day of Mass Resistance to the Bush Regime, which is coming up on October 5th with a rally in the South Park Block's amphitheater. At 9 on the Friday morning radio zine, hear a pilot of a new Jewish-Palestinian program with a focus on the Israeli-Palestine conflict, co-hosted by Halle Gores and Will Seaman. They'll feature an interview with Alon Pape, professor at Haifa University and author of numerous books on politics and history. At 10, we'll hear the best of the Whole Community's Radio Project workshops with features on the struggle, how to stop a Walmart store in Cedar Mill, Portland's Digital City Program, the toxic legacy of Plaza Town, and much more coming up on the Friday radio zine tomorrow.